mentioned the word holography once here. as I warned, I'll move on. Okay, so I am going to talk about eternal inflation, but in this is what we like to call a real landscape. Yeah. This is the Andes, I guess. Actually, I should give a photo credit to Claudia, who did this picture. I'm going to tell you a little bit about where I'm coming from on this project. I'm not natively an eternal inflationist, but I am sort of more natively a computationalist, so I'll give you how I work into both of those categories. Then I'll tell you a little bit about our model. Our goal in one sentence is just trying to put eternal inflation into a simulation. Then I'll tell you a lot more about a neat effect that we found while doing these simulations that hopefully we won't find too surprising, but I think it's something that really changes the discussion a lot. And then I'll remark, if there's time, for a couple of minutes about what extensions that we want to make. So our motivation if you'll forgive my flipping back, this is with my collaborators, Richard Easter at Yale, Lam Qui and Eugene Lim at Columbia, and this archive reference is from this morning. So if you want to go see the paper, this is the truly state of the art. Okay, so our motivation is to look for observational signatures of eternal inflation. Okay, primarily people have looked for signatures of bubble collisions and a rise in eternal inflation, and that's one of the motivations that we have. And then also whether or not gravitational radiation can be produced by the collision of many bubbles in the scenario. Although I'm new to the eternal inflation picture, I'm not so new to the lattice picture, which is where we hope to get some of the tools for this project. So in the past, some members of this collaboration and I have done some simulations using 3+1 lattice simulations in preheating and turbulence to predict gravitational wave spectra. And so we hope to use some of that technology to shed some light on the eternal inflation problem. This is quite a large project, and therefore I have the warning that it is a work in progress. So this is more of a conversation than a presentation. So if you have any comments or suggestions, we're at that stage where we're still very flexible as to the particular direction that we want to go in. So as a quick reminder, first order phase transitions have been studied for a while, probably most famously by Hawking, Moss, and Stewart, and then this collaboration, Kozowski, Turner, Watkins, and Kamenkowski. These papers were very much generalized to look at potentials in bubbles that collided and then estimating how much gravitational radiation can be produced from them. There's also other work on the observational effects of bubble collision that we heard a paper by Matt Clevin a couple days ago, maybe last Thursday, where he explained this work, but looking at effects on the CMB from bubble collision. More recently, there have been some other numerical simulations working towards putting bubble collisions explicitly on the computer. Matt Johnson was here, and I don't think he talked about this, but this is a fairly recent paper where he was starting to simulate some of these things in a completely different framework, but also starting to look at the same thing. So when I say completely different framework, what I mean is that we are explicitly looking at a 3+1 dimensional problem. Okay? So our motivation for this is twofold. Well, I guess it's really threefold. One is that we don't want to make any assumptions about symmetry just in case there happen to be modes that are unstable. If we make dimensional reductions, then we're going to miss those modes. We really want to do the full effective 3+1 treatment. The second reason why we want to do this is because we already have codes that run in 3+1 dimensions and predict gravitational waves from those, and we hope to apply those codes to this scenario. And then the third thing is that we hope to run these simulations eventually looking at many, many bubbles, and if I'm looking at many, many bubbles and we seem to live in an effective 3+1 space, then I'll need 3+1 dimensions in order to do that. The background of this uses a field evolution program that's called LatticeEasy that was written by Gary Felder. and what LatticeEasy does is it computes the Klein-Gordon equation on the lattice. Lattice EZ was built for lattices that have something like 128 cube points. We needed much more than that, so we did need to modify Lattice EZ, but not very much past. We didn't have to modify it very much for this particular application. One nice thing about Lattice EZ is that it does couple these scalar fields to an FRW metric, so that way we have a consistently expanding backpack. Yeah.
In the bigger space, did anything fundamentally change?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are questions that we're not ready to answer yet in 3D, but I'm sure that they would. So when you have, I mean, when you're talking about collisions with multiple bubbles, obviously the dimension of the space that you're working is in. Right. So that's where I think it will change. Now, the collision of two single bubbles, I don't know. Probably. I don't. Okay. So, to start with, we used the canonical model that was introduced by Coleman and DeLuccia. But we modify it a little bit to make it look a little bit more eternally inflating by adding a vacuum energy curve. Okay. So this is a two-minimum model. The leading term is a term where we have two degenerate minima, and then we have a second term that breaks that degeneracy. Lifts the right-hand minima up a little bit, and then it does nothing at this stage to add this vacuum energy term over on the right-hand side. That just gives it an overall energy. I have five parameters in this model. I have lambda and phi naught, which set basically the distance that the two minima are apart and the height of the bump between them. I have epsilon, which is the symmetry breaking factor that will tell me how different the energy between this minima and this minima is. And then I have alpha, which sets the overall lattice. So because I still have a potential that's set up with terms that look like degenerate minima, and I have a small symmetry breaking term, I can use the framework of the CDL instanton in order to approximate what the field profile should look like.
See, so I count, I see four. What am I missing? Lambda, epsilon, alpha.
Oh, sorry. Four.
Is it four?
Four, yeah. I take back my five and I close it. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. So we have four free parameters. Okay. But I can still use the CDL instanton. I can take if I put it in Euclidean time, I can write down the equations of motion for the field, assume that it's SO4 symmetric, and then I can approximate the equations of motion using the thin wall approximation dropping this term, and I can calculate a solution for the field profile. This is an exact solution to the approximate potential with the approximate equations of motion, and I'll justify using that for the full problem in a few minutes. But we do come up with an analytic solution for what the instanton should look like. Of course, this has been known for 30 years. So I want to apply some more constraint to the problem. I need to set some overall vacuum scale, so I'm going to set it at the gut scale.
I also I need to say something about the tunneling rate. And the way that we choose to put a constraint on the tunneling rate is actually by saying that the size of the bubbles that are created are some fraction of the total bubble. Okay, so it's constraining the same parameter. I'm setting that fraction of the Hubble length to be something like 10%. And that way, that seems to assure that when bubbles are created, they'll inevitably collide given this vacuum energy. So I had four parameters. I now have two constraints. Yeah. Well, I'll justify that in the next slide. I'm not using the thin wall approximation. I use the thin wall approximation to come up with an analytic solution, so that way I can put that into the code. So I need an initial condition for the bubble. But wait one more slide, and maybe you'll be happy, but I'll ask you. So I have four parameters. I have two constraints. Epsilon is always a free parameter, and so I'm just going to choose it not to be 1. I choose it to be 1 over 20. I don't know why. Oh, epsilon has to be much less than 1. I choose it to be I choose it to be 1 over 3. So now to get back to the previous question, so I'm not really using the thin wall approximation outside of coming up with a guess as to what the full solution to the full equations of motion should be using the full potential. Okay. So the thin wall approximation uses the approximate equations of motion in an approximate form of the potential. But that gives me an analytic solution, which I can then plug into the full equations of motion. And when I plug it into the full equations of motion for the full potential, I get something that is very, very close to the solution. Okay. So to how you read this graph is this is that radial coordinate in four space, and I've just plugged in the analytic solution that I got into every term in the full equations of motion, and I get this red line here, which is basically zero. When that line is zero, that means it's an exact solution. I'm sorry. Well, I'm luck. There's nothing that tells me that the thin wall approximation should be a good solution to the full equations of motion for the full potential. It turns out that it's a good guess, the first guess.
Is there a limit on how far away you can evolve from?
Well, I don't. So
there's just times when it just fails. I mean, I'm trying to remember. There's
There's surely times when it fails. I mean, but it doesn't fail here.
Isn't epsilon controlling it?
Yeah. So epsilon goes into the. You could use. So there are two different problems here. So you take epsilon. You can put that into the thin wall approximation. You can get the analytic solution. Okay.
But if epsilon is large, I don't think you're going to get a good.
Oh, probably. If epsilon is large, you can't get a good solution because it has to be just barely non-degenerate. Okay. But in this, so this is not something that's obvious. This is something that we have to test numerically. Okay. So we have this approximate solution, and we say that that's a good first guess as to what the full solution should be to the full equations of motion for the full potential. Now I put that into this formula, and it basically satisfies that equation of motion. There's a degree of luck. If it didn't, then we'd have to use something like the relaxation method to get the full solution starting from this point. Maybe we can talk about it later. But there's a little bit of luck, but it's something that we have to justify every time we come up with a new model, we try to write down a new profile. We have to make sure that the profile that we're using to nucleate these bubbles is a solution to the full equations of motion using the full potential.
But I think the point is that this is parametric. I mean, so in the argument of time, you have this first factor, this is a mass.
Okay? Right.
And the product of that mass times that zero has to be large.
Right. Yes. Yeah. No. But so.
I know, but in this case it wouldn't. So why I say it wouldn't matter is because if I did this, and it turned out not to be a good approximation, then this red line wouldn't be close to zero, and I would have to relax that solution to the full solution. But I don't have to do that yet here because, as it turns out, the thin wall approximation is a pretty good solution to full equations. Okay. Another issue of technology is that in order to believe that we're actually simulating these bubbles on the lattice, I have to make sure that I have sufficient resolution in order to see all of the features of the wall itself. And so if I look at the number of lattice points per side, I've chosen the two strongest resolutions that we have. We really have to go up to 1024 cubed lattice points in order to get enough points along the wall that you really resolve all of the features of the bubble. I alluded to this before, but Lattice EV isn't natively built to do lattices this big. It's built to do lattices about one-tenth the size, or one-tenth cubed the size. So modifications had to be made. And to just put it as a challenge, one of these structures, a single field that has 1024 points, requires 8 gigabytes of storage locally. So that has been a big concern.
Think that some of them wouldn't be well approximated by a thin wall approximation.
Why?
Which normally physics minimizes an action.
Like the same kind of model.
I don't think that. They would vary by some. I mean, they're all not going to be perfectly identical, but that's something that we can't address yet until we do the case where we look at.
It's okay if this is just a first step, but I'm just wondering if there was a physics reason why you were just studying the thin wall bubbles being nucleated and colliding.
The main answer is it's the first step. But the second answer is I have to make sure that we understand that this is, although we use the thin wall approximation to write down an analytic form, that analytic form is a good solution to the full equation system. So I'm not using the thin wall approximation anymore. I use the thin wall approximation to come up with a guess. I use that guess to find out, I use that as a first guess to the full equations of motion. It worked within our tolerance, and we didn't need to relax it anymore to the full system.
But it isn't always a good approximation. Right?
It is for these parameters. If I choose different parameters or choose a new model, I have to check it again. But I don't.
I just wanted to comment. The other question of why not fluctuate around this, I mean, that has to do with the goodness of the semi-classical tunneling process. And that's usually extremely good. So I think that's a separate question about whether fluctuations around the semi-classical.
Right. So we assume if bubbles nucleate differently, there's some perturbation to the solution that we've written. And we will study that in the future, but I don't need it for the points that I want to make.
Was that just saying the action very large or something? It's a slow tunnel.
Yeah.
Which can be true with or without the thin wall process. That's a separate.
Okay. So I have a movie. Let's go ahead.
Try to absorb the 18 bytes.
So this is undersampled by a factor of 8 in order to make it processable by computer. On the left-hand side is the field profile. On the right-hand side is the energy density through a slice through the middle of the bubble. This is co-moving coordinates.
So this is done. This is doing self-consistently.
Okay.
Mm.
So it looks like a bubble, but really it's very hard. Okay. So towards the end of the simulation, we do get some noise leaking into the interior of the bubble. You shouldn't believe what these things that look like the fraction fringes that come from the undersampling. You should be worried that the bubble seems to have a tail that leaks into it, and that turns out to be something that is a true problem with the numerical simulation. Okay. But this bubble has grown quite a lot during the length of the simulation, so we won't allow the simulations to run this late if we're going to believe everything that's happening in the physics. Yeah.
This is just my own ignorance of how the simulations work, but can you say a bit more precisely what you mean when you say that you're undersampling by a factor of 8?
Oh, sure. So these are run on a lattice that's 1024 cubed,
uh-huh.
And I only output every 8th point in every direction.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it's not as if, okay.
No, the pictures are undersampled, not the simulation is 1024 right. cubed. The pictures are 1/8.
So classical field evolution is known to have an ultraviolet catastrophe.
Yes.
And these little fringes are making me start to think about them, but you'll get to that. You'll cut.
I won't address that here because we're not at the level of worrying about the power cascade. So we don't ever do any spectral analysis. So like when you're looking for gravitational radiation, that's very important because you can have power that cascades into the ultraviolet and then you don't see it anymore and you can't really. We're looking at the pure, at this stage, we're looking at just the position space evolution of the field. Okay.
So you're hoping it doesn't feedback.
We're not even worried about that at this point. We will be when we get to gravitational radiation in 3 years from now. at this point, we're not overwhelmed.
But also, I guess in this case, you just have a smooth classical field configuration. As long as the resolution is high enough, you wouldn't expect to have a lot of power.
I did address this problem quickly and inappropriately when I said that I needed enough points to fully resolve the features on the wall. At this point, the wall's getting too thin, and I can't fully resolve those features, which is why you have to look at this with a little bit of anxiety. Okay, so to just introduce you to some of the diagrams that I'm going to use for the rest of the talk, this is the normal co-moving diagram that some people like showing bubbles. This is the previous simulation, just in two dimensions. The interior of the bubble is blue, the exterior of the bubble is this tan color. The bubbles accelerate, but then will asymptotically reach some finite size because the space is expanding. I will prefer to use conformal light diagrams that show the bubble walls actually approaching the speed of light during the simulation. Actually, this might be the only conformal diagram that I use. I'm going to speak to these. So. Oh, sorry.
Only co-moving.
Only conformal.
That's conformal is what you will use.
I will use conformal, yeah. But some people tend to really like these co-moving diagrams. Okay. So what I can do with this is I had information both from the field configuration and from the energy density, so I can show both what the field configuration looks like, where you can clearly see that there's a region that's in one minimum, there's a region that's in a different minimum. And I can also show you a conformal diagram showing the energy density. And this is what you'd expect, that there's much more energy along the bubble wall than there is inside or outside of the bubble. You can start to see energy leaking off into the bubble here, and that's exactly that noise that I showed you. That's the noise that I showed you during the simulation. Right, yeah, that's the nucleation event. Okay, and you can see that the walls start off at rest. This is the beginning of the simulation. So now you ask, okay, well, maybe I've convinced you that I can create a bubble on the lattice, and it displays the features of bubbles that we'd like to see. So the next question is, of course, what about bubble collisions? First step, two bubbles on a lattice, and I have another movie. Okay. So these guys are separated by a little more. There's a little more than three times the bubble radius. They slam into each other, and we can watch what happens to the classical field evolution as the interact. Yes, yep. This model only has 2 minutes, but I will address your question in detail momentarily. This is expanding, so the space is expanding, but it's homogeneous with expanding. Okay, so the expansion is ruled by the vacuum energy that I have, so these are co-moving coordinates.
When they collide, they produce a singularity. So it's just
okay. Yeah. No, I wouldn't see that here. I wouldn't see that.
So, but you don't have. You're not solving GR equations.
I'm not solving GR equations. Okay. No. The expansion is purely driven by the existence of a vacuum energy, which we assume to be much larger. Much larger. Actually, we hope that it was much larger, and as it turns out, it is much larger than any of the differences in energy at any one point. So, let me see. Things that you want to pick out of this is that, again, we have this late time noise, but we don't have to worry about that when the two bubbles actually collide. We saw some, maybe I can run it again and point these things out. Once the two bubbles collide, we start to see energy flowing along the bubble wall. Okay, this is something that's also expected. We also see some perturbations, some tiny perturbations of the field leaking up into the interior of the two bubbles. I can put this into the conformal diagram, the conformal diagrams that I've been talking about. So the upper one is the field configuration, the lower one is the energy density. I have the two bubbles, which are in green, which are in the lower minimum. The tan part is in the higher minimum. The bubble walls come together, they collide. During the collision, we have this interaction zone, okay? And on that interaction zone, there are perturbations of energy. One thing to notice is those perturbations of energy kick the field back up into the higher minimum. I'll talk about that more in a minute. We can also see that on the energy density diagram that the walls come together, they collide with each other, and the energy follows the borders between the two lower minima and then the created regions of the higher minima.
we see a little bit of radiation heading off into the center of both of the bubbles. That radiation is about 1 part in 10 to the 5th of the radiation that's contained in the bubble in this interaction surface itself. So it is truly negligible compared to the energy that stays on that interaction. It's about 10 to minus 5. No. Yeah, so Hawking, Moss, and Stewart, Hawking, Moss, and Stewart put different conditions on this with multiple fields, that it, depending on where the vacuums are relative to each other, you get more or less radiation. It's something that's not immediately, it's not necessarily dependent on the parameters in the problem as much as it's set upon where the bubbles collide, how much energy the bubble walls had, what the geometry of the situation was, et cetera. Speaking of that, this is an effect that you shouldn't find surprising because Hawking, Moss, and Stewart showed it in their original paper, and also Kozowski and Turner. During this, they both use the same model that, well, basically the same model that we're using. You have two minima. When the bubbles of lower minima collide, they create these regions of back in the higher minima.
I think there seems to be a period.
There's some periodicity that's set because once those tiny bubbles form, mm-hmm. the pressure forces them to collapse, and then they form smaller and smaller.
I see.
So here's a blow up of the interaction plane. And I guess I already said this, but it may be nice to see a larger picture of it. But remember, these things here come from sampling issues. The fact that this looks discrete, that's actually continuous. It's just a problem with how many points I can plot.
It's actually discrete on a factor of eight smaller scale.
Right, it would look prettier if I had all. Okay, so in case you're worried about different resolutions, I can do a comparison on the upper panels with the 512 cubed and on the lower panels with the 1024 cubed. For the most part, we can trust the picture in both cases, but we do see that there are some differences between what we get in the 512 and what we get in the. Okay, so it is important for us to go to the best resolution that we have possible in order to. It is a little bit
different. So the radiation, because it's one of these tiny effects, is something that we see much more clearly in the 1024 than we do in the 512. You can see that here, right? That this stuff here is not nearly as well resolved as the radiation that we see in the 1024. So we can do it for a simple two minima model. Now let's do it for a three minima model. Okay. I still have four parameters. I have lambda and phi naught, which basically will set which set the width and the height of the barriers in between different minima. I also have epsilon, which is a symmetry breaking factor, which will allow this barrier and this barrier to have different vacuum energy. And then I'll keep this vacuum energy to make it look a little bit more like eternal inflation. In this case, I'm going to choose epsilon to be 1 over 40. Here's the same argument. I have to try to find out what the bubble profiles are going to look like. For that, I start by guessing the CDL solution. I can use the approximate potential, that is the potential that's spread. I can use the approximate potential along with the thin wall approximation to come up with an analytic form of what the bubble wall should look like. They're different for the two bubbles, of course, because there's a different vacuum energy difference between them. I think I took out the slide that shows that comparison plot before, but I have to, again, check these solutions to make sure that they are a solution to the full equations of motion using the full potential. And as it turns out, they're actually a better solution than we had in the previous.
I mean the Euclidean equations of motion, right? So the thin wall approximation allows us to get rid of a term in the Euclidean equations of motion, which make these things analytic.
Or from the beginning, you could just numerically solve the Euclidean equations.
No. So the boundary conditions are the non-trivial solution to the Euclidean equations of motion. meaning that you have to, the interior of the bubble is at one minima, the exterior of the bubble is at a different one, and then you can't say a lot about the derivatives except for infinity. So you can't just use a standard integrator. You have to make the first guess, and then you have to use the relaxation.
Okay, so that's good.
Okay. Which is the plan, but we don't have to. The relaxation method makes this worse.
Let's take on the loss of that. I mean, like, if you had the exact to sitter, then it just continues off to some learning.
Oh, no, but the tunneling event itself is a solution to the Euclidean action. It's a maximization of the Euclidean.
Right, but doesn't that just analytically continue to one of these bubbles that's got old, what is it, O31 or
right. Yeah, but I have to write down that solution first. And so what we're talking about is how you actually come up with that O4 symmetric solution before you continue. Maybe I don't understand the question.
No, but this is the continuation, it's just an analytic continuation. So I mean if you had an exact solution, it would just have this symmetry limiter.
Right, yeah.
Or are you breaking the symmetry?
No. Even so, the exact solution would have the symmetry, the Sidwall approximation has that same symmetry.
Right.
So
you can, maybe, so in principle, you can compare your numerical thing with the exact solution, I suppose. Because there is an exact solution.
There is an exact solution using the Sidwall approximation. If I don't, there's an extra term in the equations of motion that makes this non-analytic. So I have to use a numerical simulation for the field term. Maybe I've confused my point, but...
I thought it just doesn't have a simple form, but is there... I'm a little surprised it would be non-analytic. Is the Euclidean solution non-analytic? I don't mean can you write it down? I mean, does it have the mathematical properties of being analytic?
Yes.
Probably.
So would the continuation to the Lorentzian, would that also be analytic, or?
If you have the SO4 symmetric solution,
right.
then you can always analytically continue.
Right. So could you check your numerical, because numerically you're actually evolving it numerically. Can you check how close your numerical is to being having the
SO4? Oh, absolutely. And it is. I mean, it's just a hyperbola.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So you can just write down the equation motion for hyperbola and plan it on top of it.
Yeah.
That was a very early test.
Yeah.
Again, I have to talk about resolution, okay? And in this case, I'm using both 1024, and we can be pretty happy about the number of points that are along the field profile at the radiation event. I'm going back for a second just to so this the one on the left hand side that is bubbles that are formed in this lower minima. Have a much larger radius than bubbles that are formed in the not-so-low minima. And that's why we have more points along this wall. The bubbles are larger, also the walls are larger, so we have better resolution for the bigger bubble than we do for the small. I'm going to use the same constraints as before. I'm going to use the same constraints as before. Gut scale vacuum energy. I have two different size bubbles. I take their average. I set that to be 1/10 of the Hubble scale. And then I'm also going to say that epsilon is much less than 0, and it's 1 over 4. Again, I have to check to make sure that it's a solution to the full potential using the full equations of motion. Okay, this is scaled differently than the last plot, but this red line is a better fit than the previous one that I had. Okay. And this goes, the moral of this story is that the instanton with the thin wall approximation is just a guess. We've been lucky in the two different models that we've tried so far that guess is really as good as we can get numerically towards the exact solution to the full equations of motion using the full equation.
So that statement confuses me. So, unless you have the full solution, how do you know how good a guess it is?
Because the full solution satisfies the differential equation. So if this equals 0.
Yeah, but do you know the full solution?
If this equals 0, then it's a solution to the differential equation.
So I think the difference is between A and Z.
He's not
close to A solution.
A solution.
Yeah.
I mean, there are two obvious solutions. One is the trivial one.
Okay.
And then this is the other.
So do you have a handle on how good an approximation this with the extra 12 with this? Now with 3 minima. Do you have a, I mean, I would think that would be that they would think that the space of solutions where the CDL is a good approximation would be even smaller than is the two minima solution.
But I'm setting epsilon when I do. I'm not writing down this solution. I'm not writing down this field profile without choosing an epsilon first. I'm not saying that this is extendable to all values of epsilon or all values of the different parameters in the model. What I'm saying is that when I make the choices that I made on the previous slide, I write down a CDL approximation that is as good a solution to the full equations of motion using the full potential than anything else I can, including if I take that solution and use the relaxation method on it to try to come up with a better solution.
And when you do the relaxation method, you're also putting the condition on epsilon?
Yes, of course. I can't use the relaxation method unless I set all of the parameters.
So when you pick, 1/40th rather than 1/50th, 1/60th, or...
It looked pretty. Yeah, I mean, so yes, there is a huge question of parameter dependence, right? And I can't address that yet. I will on my last slide, but not just.
Why don't you relax? Why don't you use the relaxation? I can see that it wouldn't change things much, but it would have avoided all of this discussion.
I think this is an important point to make, in that the relaxation method isn't stable because of the nature of the differential equation, because of the nature of this differential equation. So we have the coordinate in the denominator here. So when I put this guess into the relaxation method, it gets worse. So I'm surely not going to use that worse solution than the approximate solution that I get from making the instant.
So you mean it's unstable, so it's actually...
Right, this is a very...
The relaxation would take you to the trivial solution.
The relaxation, yes, would take you to the trivial solution. In some cases, in other cases, it just breaks.
But you're interested in the physics of the collision, not the nucleation.
Right, exactly. And I think that, right. And so the test of that is, once we put it into the simulation, do we see things that we don't cast? If I put in solutions that are crazy, which I have done as I was trying to find the best solution, right, you see wiggles, you see the wall. After you start the simulation, you see the wall change shape into a better solution and then propagate. And
you don't see that. You're taking valid initial conditions, and it just might not be the maximal Euclidean instanton, but it will be some.
It is closer than anything else that we can write down.
So Euclidean, the Lorentzian evolution doesn't send a signal. I mean, suppose you started off with it wasn't the equivalent to the Euclidean instanton, and evolved. Does it tend to get closer and closer to what Euclidean?
Yes, but then you can't believe it, because then there's a big question about what effects you've introduced during that point at which it's relaxing, would lack of a better word, to a better solution. Right? You create perturbations that head both out of the bubble and into the bubble, and that's a mess that we avoid by taking the best guess.
So I just one short comment, and it's not really it. I think we are taking this Euclidean solution too seriously, because you want to cut it off at some point. Right. At some point, there was no bubble. This cannot be SO3-1 symmetric all the way. And so that cutoff is going to break Lorentz invariance. So it's going to break Lorentz.
But why? If the initial conditions are exactly the same as that, I mean, you just forget about it. I mean, you could have evolved into the basket.
But we know that bubble nucleated at some point, right?
Right. And I want to stay away from that point. But it is important that we come up with the reason why we choose this class of instance on solutions is because the bubble walls are at rest at nucleation. So when we write down the classical field equations of motion, we just have to set the bubble wall profile. We don't have to worry about the initial conditions on the derivative. And then we see this behavior that we expected. Okay. Let me run this again, since we may have missed it. Okay? So we have a larger bubble on the left, we have a smaller bubble on the right. The smaller bubble is in the more different minima, which I think I said incorrectly a few slides ago, but nobody caught me. I'm sorry?
So which two minima are these?
So the lower one is in the lower minima over here, and the bigger one is in this minima here.
I can see a big difference between the size of both bubbles initially, but I can't see a big difference between
Right, and the physical reason for that is that there's a bigger difference in energy, in the vacuum energy, so the walls accelerate faster.
Okay.
That actually is one of the confirmations that we needed to see in this, and if we were going to believe it. So we collide these two bubbles with each other, and we see a lot of features that we like to see. Okay, so here's the field configuration. This is the rightmost minimum, which is not as low. This is the leftmost minimum, which is somewhat lower. Okay. They eat up the green space, which is the false vacuum. They create a domain wall between the two that heads away from the region of lower vacuum. Okay. This is a picture that was guessed in the Chang and Levin paper. Okay. The crux of their argument about why we should see effects on the CMB lie on the fact that there exists this domain wall that's moving relative to your position with the bubble. We can also look at the energy density. We can see that the energy density lies across all of those planes. What you may not have expected was this little bump of green that appears in the domain wall. Okay. Now, it's been known in the simulations of two minima that you come up with this small region during the interaction that goes back into the original minimum. In this model, we come up with a region during the interaction that's in the original minimum, and this was not expected. I have a close-up. This little region in field space that you can see is it zero? And it's some finitely sized region. Now, that region has the highest of all of the vacuum energies available, and therefore that region is going to be squeezed away, which is exactly what we see on the diagram. That region gets squeezed away if this wall starts to move quickly, and so those regions are contracted, but there are additional regions up here.
But then, you say it was not expected, but we showed that in the symmetric case also.
It did, but this does not show up, say, in the Chang and Levin. So what I'm saying is that when we write down what this interaction should look like, we know that there's a domain wall there, and it's not obvious that there's a region on that domain wall in the false vacuum. We maybe should have expected, but maybe didn't.
So, and what is this blue coming from?
The periodic boundary conditions on the walls. Sorry.
Are there ever any parameters where that little green region is big enough that it starts to
then you could have a classical.
Oh, never did.
I want to make sure I get credit for this.
It's too late. This morning it's up. Anyway, so the question is it a generic quality? All right. So the question is it a generic quality that we create regions during bubble collisions that are in different minima? I'm talking too slowly, so I will speed up. So what do? We come up with a new potential. The base of this potential, the non-degenerate part, the degenerate part, is the same as the last, so I can use the same instanton, basically, as I did before. Okay. I'm choosing a different epsilon to answer some of the previous questions because I want to. I'm going to choose this yellow curve this time. But now what I'm going to do is I'm going to start the bulk and the uppermost vacuum. I'm going to nucleate two bubbles in the middle. Right? Ooh. Oh, wait, it hasn't happened. Get ready. Okay. So, what do I see? I see two bubbles in that middle minimum. They collide with each other. The field moves into a region of field space that's not already been used. Okay. That region of field space has a lower vacuum energy. Therefore, that pocket is not unstable. It's quite stable and expands. In the picture that I've drawn here, this is expanding space. that then, given the periodic boundary conditions, consumes the entire space.
Well, let's see. So the outside was the highest vacuum, the intermediate was the, okay, sorry, in between the bubble was the intermediate vacuum,
yep.
And after colliding, it formed the lowest.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah. So is this generic? Well, let me give you a very technical derivation. I have more. Don't worry. I have to get to those too. Anyway, so let me try to make a guess about whether or not this effect is generic, and I'm going to do so in a parameterless quote unquote way. Okay. So what I mean by that is I want to kind of talk about the features of the potential independent of the specific parameters of the model that I've put up. So I'm going to do that by talking about the model in terms of how far away the minima are in field space, and then the relative heights of the barrier compared to the height of the original minimum. I can approximate the bubble wall thickness just using Lorentz contraction, where the initial width of the bubble is just given by the instant. The initial, that's the initial thickness, and then the Lorentz factor is given to us by the fact that the continuation of the instanton tells us that the walls are hyperbolic. If I look at the equations of motion, I can approximate what's going to happen to a point when the two bubbles intersect with each other. When the two bubbles intersect, most of these derivatives are zero, except there is a second derivative in the field. It's helpful, and I didn't have the PowerPoint skills to write this, but to kind of give a cartoon of what the field looks like at this point, okay? So the two bubbles are in one minimum, and then in between those two bubbles, the field is in a different minimum, and then these walls are headed in this direction, okay? So if I'm studying this point here, that point is at rest. There's no first derivative of the field, but there is a second derivative. I'm doing this approximation in flat space because I'm looking really at just that instant when the two bubbles collide. At the point of collision, I can approximate that second derivative just using the parameters that I'm talking about. That will accelerate that point in the field, right? Second derivative. That'll accelerate downwards. That will give the field kinetic energy in field space. The field will only slow down when it hits a force due to the potential. We can approximate the force as it heads towards the first bump, which is the bump that makes the field go from here to here. And we can see that this energy here just has to be bigger than this, which is always true so far as gamma is bigger than 1. If gamma is less than 1, then we should have a different compensation. Okay. So you'll always get over the first minima. I think we all believe that. But if there's another minimum, then the potential force to slow down the field isn't given by this. Rather, it's given by this. And I can make a slightly more generic statement if I assume that delta phi 12 is approximately equal to delta phi 13. That in order to get over that next barrier, the Lorentz factor of the walls at collision has to be bigger than this ratio. The square of the Lorentz factor has to be bigger than that ratio of the two bubble. If you think, and there's no reason why you should or shouldn't, but if you think that there's some characteristic size of barriers on the landscape, or whatever multiple minimum model of scalar fields that you like to look at, then there's no real reason why VB13 and VB12 should be radically different from each other. And if they're not radically different from each other, then gamma doesn't have to be much bigger than 1 in order for the field to start transversing more barriers. In field. We want to be a little bit more conservative than that, so I've introduced a parameter beta that basically talks about dissipation of energy due to other effects. Say you're coupled to other light fields, and those can carry away some of the energy. Say there's some perturbations in the fields that transfer into the bubbles. Say someone steals your energy, that can be assumed into beta here. But beta would have to be quite small if you wanted to make gamma something incredibly large. So, I'm going to show you a movie.
The left-hand frame is going to be bubbles that are nucleated very close to each other, such that the Lorentz factor of the walls is one. This is the going back to the same model that I showed before. The Lorentz factor of the walls at collision is going to be gamma is equal to 1.3. Okay? The bubbles have to be a small fraction of their bubble radius apart in order to only be moving that fast at collision. On the right-hand side, I'm going to show you a more realistic model where the bubbles are separated by almost three bubble radii, no less than three bubble radii, 2.8 bubble radii at their nucleation. Therefore, the space in between the two bubble walls is less than a bubble radius, but the walls achieve a gamma of 1.7 when they come. Okay. So these are very close together. They collide with each other. They don't have quite enough energy to make it. These guys here are gamma of 1.7, and they have plenty of energy to make it over them. Okay. I don't actually have the authority to say this, but I'll say it anyway. In order to get a gamma as low as this, you really need a very high nucleation rate, which, anyway, if you want to suppress this process, the most obvious way is to assume that you have an extremely high tunneling rate. Empirically, we see that this collision tends to occur if the Lorentz factor of the walls comes to be like 1.4. Okay, if the Lorentz factor of the walls in this particular model is greater than 1.4 or so, then we can make the statement that this is a generic consequence of bubble collision. In the cases when it doesn't occur, well, that's when we go back to something that maybe we wanted to see when we started, at least we wanted to see it when we started, and that is more radiation and debris going into both the bubbles. It's our hope when we started all of these numerical simulations was to get an idea of what information goes into the bubble after. Okay.
Is that statement about gamma?
We've done it at the best resolution that we can find. I haven't run it at 512 because I don't trust 512 as much as I trust 1024. Okay. So
it sounds like you suspect its resolution.
How so?
Well, because so you don't trust the next lower resolution, so why should I
conclude? Oh, I should say I don't trust it as much, but I mean, so would it make you feel better if the lower resolution also transitioned, or do you think, I mean?
You can answer that question however you want, but this is an important question. Is this phenomenon?
I have a definite 512 and even lower resolution test runs where the transition occurs. And do I run at 15 different gammas? No. But I don't know. So
the question really would be whether the energy dissipation scales, right? I mean, that would be the only thing that could change with resolution would be how efficiently energy is dissipated. The phenomenon seems.
Well, I agree.
Okay, so we.
I mean, I have that sort of prejudice too, but at some point it's seeding. There's the seeding process at the beginning, and I.
So let me put it this way. Okay, so let's say I run it at a lower resolution and more radiation is produced. Or if I run it at a higher resolution and more radiation is produced, okay. then we have to say something more. We have to maybe make another estimate on what this gamma should be. Okay. Is that gamma at 512 cubed 4? No. It's not. I can't even run bubbles that get that fast before they go in. And I see this transition. Is it 1.6? Well, then that doesn't really change what I said, right? If it's 2, it doesn't really change what I said. So in a way, sure. Can I say gamma is the transition happens at 1.44? I think that there's much more that goes into the physics than that. That beta parameter, you know, could change by, you know, maybe right now beta is around a half. If I make beta 0.75 because there's an extra field coupled to the model, then it's going to change what that it's going to change what gamma is, but it's not going to make it 20 or 50.
But of course, the bar is that if you do it at higher resolution, this doesn't happen for some reason.
So you should.
But that would we would have to something catastrophic would have to happen that.
Wow, I don't know.
So I mean, there's a side of me that says intuitively it's probably not going to be a problem, but there, you know, there could be a worry that at the beginning of this thing, this little green wedge you showed us, is numerical noise creating.
Let me go back to the plot, and you can play to the width. So you're talking about the conformal diagram here? You're talking about this thing here?
No, well, go back a little more. Where'd it go? The first place you said you might not have expected this, but here it is.
Oh!
This guy here. So could that be numerical noise?
No. No, that is a robust feature, and I will say that with confidence because I see it whenever I run this, and I see it in Hawking, Moss, and Stewart, and I see it in Kozowski and Turner, and I see it in the new papers by Matt Johnson and all.
And the scale and the
size of these is parameter dependent. It's model dependent.
But numerically.
Yes, and so there are more than a couple of lattice points in this region. If that's the question.
Well, part of the question is it do the features, are they robust? Are there features of that region robust against lattice change?
Yes. I can say that confidently. But the features, the meaning that the so the size, and so one there are two effects that I'm going to qualify the statement with. One is that the size and dynamics of this feature are something that are model dependent. So the follow up to that is for this model, that feature is resolution dependent. It's not is resolution dependent. Yes.
I mean, saying that this feature was numerical noise, I mean, all the interactions in your lattice are local.
Yes.
So, I mean, it would just be saying that you had some spurious higher dimension operator in your Lagrangian, effectively, that was causing this thing. But since we don't know what the higher dimension operators are in the real theory, who cares, right?
Well, this is... I don't know what higher dimensional operators would do. Would they have a change in the field dynamics? Probably, but they're probably suppressed compared to the gradient terms and the things.
Right, but I mean, by the same token, the numerical noise is probably suppressed when your resolution is so fine, which, you know, it's very fine.
Right.
So
it's been studied for the standard model for sort of phase transition higher dimensional operators, and they are a small percent level of that.
Okay, so what I dare put this up. So, if you don't think what I'm doing so far is speculative, here are my speculations. I address this in a statement. Can this be the dominant form of bubble collisions in any particular model? That is a model dependent, it is a measure dependent statement. But the easiest way to suppress this is to have a very high tunneling rate. If you have a very high tunneling rate, then you probably don't like your model. Two, implications for the landscape. It's a mechanism to move around the landscape that doesn't rely on probability. So that's something that has to be taken into account in any model in which you don't have an extremely high tunneling rate, but you have bubble collisions occurring. Can we come up with observational signatures that tell us that our universe is inside one of these classically nucleated bubbles? The most obvious of which is geometrical, because the space that's formed is highly anisotropic. And so what would we have to do to that space in order to turn it into a universe that we live in? And then I can also speculate about a way of relaxing the cosmological constant down to a lower value. This is a double-edged sword, because in order for this to be an efficient method for that, we also need some symmetry to preserve us having anti-de Sitter minima. I'll say those quickly and move on to the next slide. We have so much to do in the future. We want to do more bubbles. We want to see what happens when we have many bubbles interacting with each other. We want to get a better idea of how to quantify this
energy that's being transported into the bubble, and we need a really a better way to quantify that. We'd like to extend this to more toy models, unless we're as lucky as we've been so far, that'll include having to come up with a more robust way of relaxing into the instanton solution. Hopefully, we'll be able to look at gravitational radiation once we collide many bubbles, and then also look into coupling with the Mohr field. I think I said most of it. I can take one question.
No. I mean, you switched off gravity in the simulation, and it's already referenced. I mean, people do have this idea that sometimes it's collisions for, you know, for similarities.
Right.
Okay, what's the justification that, you know, that this is going to survive?
The energy, sure, the contribution to the energy density during the collision event is perturbative compared to the vacuum energy.
It's produced singularities, and that's invalidated.
But you, I don't think you can if it's, so if it's perturbative, you can't. Now, if we go to a very low vacuum energy, and then the gradients are large compared to the vacuum energy, then...
So these are non-linear equations, right?
Right, absolutely, absolutely. And that's something, so we can't produce singularities on our simulation, but we can produce what the energy density as a function of space looks like, which then can be put into a matching condition or something to find out if things like that. I need a bigger computer. If anyone has a bigger computer.
But in non-gravity, it's just it's not realistic anything to come, I guess.
I would say in the next year, it's not realistic. But in the next couple of years, it certainly have to get a good friend.
I didn't quite understand your comment about the high nucleation rate that is suppressing the
bubble. Sure, if you have a high nucleation rate, the bubbles are nucleated close to each other. So the bubble walls don't achieve a.
Right, but with this trick, you try to tell me if you, of course, the transition between the bubbles will perforate in this
case. Right, but so if say you, if you had. Okay, so you have this model, right? And the nucleation rate here is very high. And so the entire space fills up with these bubbles that are all nucleated close to each other. No two bubbles are nucleated more than a fraction of the bubble radius apart. Very high nucleation rate. Then maybe the entire universe gets to this spot before any of the walls get a gamma larger than 1.2. No, I mean 1.92.
But then it's a second order phase transition, right? I mean, it's not a first order phase transition. It shouldn't be well described by first order phase transition.
Well,
if any bubbles close to each other are nucleating all like crazy, then that's physically what a second order phase transition.
Sure,
is.
But I won't go so far as to think I'm being as conservative as possible with the statement that I made. And the most obvious way to suppress this.
I mean, that prevents the phenomenon.
I'm not going to go on the record with that, but you're getting paid. No. So
it's clear. I mean, if you have a high nucleation rate, I mean, how about all together phase?
I will not disagree.
But I mean, there's other ways of suppressing gamma. That's what you're interested in. Any of these bubbles have an inherent expanding phase, a terminal velocity, which corresponds to the gamma factor of 1 over h times r.
Is that true, though? I think that the gamma is always, because the bubbles will always be accelerating in a local frame, right? The gamma is always going to be given by the physical radius of the bubble compared to the initial size of the bubble. So this is a coordinate independence.
What you want to say is the distance between the bubbles that the size, right?
Sorry, but...
Yeah, so if you put them at a certain distance, D.
Right.
You compare that to the size.
Right.
And that's the gamma.
No. So this is just the physical radius of the bubble at the time of collision compared to the initial size of the bubble.
So
and that's because if you put it into...
Of course,
you
expect it to be at the speed of light at the same
time. Right.
Okay. But if you are in the sitter, the distance, the original distance, cannot be bigger than h.
Right.
So this formula converts into 1 over h or not.
Okay, so let me draw that conformally. So I can have two bubbles that don't ever collide. But this bubble wall at this point has a lot of energy, so even if it collides there, the argument that I made here still suggests that there's enough energy available to push that field into the lower. So I'm not talking about, so it should be clear that when I put up these plots and I say what gamma is, that's not an estimate based on their initial separation. That gamma that I show is the actual radius of the bubble compared to its initial radius.
Yes, it's the gamma that I'm telling you. It's also the relative gamma factor. So it's 1 over h gamma.
Okay. But maybe we should talk about this offline, because maybe I'm not completely understanding it. But I don't think it requires both walls to have that gamma factor in order to make the transition.
All I'm saying is that there is a maximum gamma factor, relative gamma factor between the two walls.
Yes.
This doesn't go indefinitely when you're in an expanding fashion.
Okay, but I'm choosing the gamma factor relative to a time slice through the bubble at nucleation.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Okay. Well, let's stop later because I'm a little confused, so it would be nice to be
honest. Yeah, I just wanted to just make this point again because I wasn't sure if it was me. At some point, your ambition with the number of bubbles and such needs to be limited by existence and reality. The phenomena of second order phase transition. So, do you have any physical intuition or understanding as to how, when that's going to happen, or when is your ambition limited by that?
I'll say it's a model dependent statement, right? So
as far as I understand this, these things get close together, and you have lots of bubbles around each other colliding a lot. It is no longer, at some point, definitely a first order phase transition, and all of the stuff you're doing is not an applicable analysis, right? But there must be some point like that.
Sure. I hesitate to say more than that. So I don't want to overstep my implications until I'm 100% sure. But take this statement at its phrase, is that the easiest way to suppress this process is by having a very high nucleation rate. If that high nucleation rate means you no longer have first order phase transition, or it means that internal inflation is no longer a viable scenario, I'm not going to make those connections. But I'm going to say that the high nucleation rate will suppress this.
So, I mean, what I'm trying to grasp at is this: at some point, your simulation has to tell you that it's no longer. I mean, at what point do you stop leaving your simulation with respect to number of bubbles and high nucleation rates? I mean, what happens?
Well, I'm not simulating the nucleation bubbles, right? I'm setting an initial condition where there are bubbles nucleated, and it's a first guess. Okay? So I'm not allowing the space to nucleate bubbles one again. So maybe that's the confusion. My simulation won't tell me anything about second order phase transition or first order phase transition unless I put those initial conditions.
Well, the point, though, right, is that I don't think the interest is in the near second order phase transition case. You're just saying that there gives a new effect. Everybody always thought that new bubbles always came from nucleations. He's saying that new bubbles may not usually come from nucleations. And the typical scenarios that people have thought about, bubbles collide, and bubbles collisions will cause new bubbles, generically, whenever first order phase transitions are a good description. And so you used to think, let me estimate bubble nucleation rates, and that will tell me how many bubbles I get. If this is true, then that is a bad calculation.
Yeah, but this gets to my point, which is that if you're saying that bubbles colliding are leading to more bubbles, you're increasing your number of bubbles.
Right.
And at some point, it's got to be not well described by first order phase transition technology.
Exactly. Precise. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. That's exactly the whole point. But it's not changing the bubble nucleation rate. It's changing the bubble formation rate, which is not the nucleation.
Yeah, sure. But it's going to not be, either way, it's not going to be described well by first order phase.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, good.
But the point is that if you, but everybody, so there's.
But he's getting this out of an analysis that is based on first order phase transition.
Yeah, so the point
is if it tells you to get more bubbles, which tells you that it should be well described by second order phase transition, how do you not know that some
sure,
the analysis isn't self consistent?
I think that would be fine.